You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Janaea Williams, in for Steve Chiatakis. On this spring day in Carson, it's a perfect 70 degrees. It looks beautiful outside. But in this part of town, resident Jan Victor Ann Dawson says the air isn't as beautiful as it looks.
Mainly the rotten egg smell is the one that's probably like goes that I smell right away and that I smell the most.
Their experience isn't surprising. Late last month, the American Lung Association delivered another scathing review of the L.A. Long Beach area in its annual air quality report card. It ranked number one for worst ozone nationwide and number four for annual particle pollution. Another lifelong resident, State Senator Lena Gonzalez, has taken notice.
We've been so desensitized by this bad air quality. I think everyone is just sort of going along, going through the motions. But at the reality is this air quality is so horrible that it's causing, in some cases, cancer, asthma, nosebleeds at the least. And unfortunately, we still have to ask for money from the Port of Long Beach to add filters to many of our classrooms because they're in such poor shape. And in the summertime, it gets even worse when there's extreme heat. And then you have bad air quality on top of that. So kids can't play outside.
Gonzalez is trying to do something about that by writing a bill aimed at one of the major creators of that pollution, local oil refineries. Just how big a difference will that make for her neighbors? More on that now from KCRW's Kaylee Wells.
When Jan Victor and Dawson moved to Carson from the Philippines 26 years ago, they thought the sight of flares and the smell of rotten eggs was just par for the course living in America.
I developed asthma in about a year when I came here, because we were like only a few hundred feet away from the rail yard and the refineries.
Their mom developed asthma as an adult, and their brother had to sleep with a nebulizer.
Every night, I'd see my parents rush to put him on the machine, and this dripping thing that somehow all that, and I didn't even know that whole process of that machine would allow him to breathe.
Here in Carson, there are plenty of culprits to share the blame. The 710 and 405 freeways, the ports of LA and Long Beach, the rail yards, the scrap recyclers, the oil refineries. There are a lot of them. Half of the state's refineries are right here in the LA area. It took until college for Jan to realize their asthma might be related to where they lived in LA County. Because when they went off to UCLA, suddenly breathing got a lot easier.
So I didn't need an inhaler. I forgot that I had asthma. It's so funny.
They moved home after graduation, and a year later, the asthma came back. If in Dawson or anyone else in LA wants to complain about bad air, they can call the South Coast Air Quality Management District. But the law that requires them to respond to those complaints has some holes. For one thing, smaller oil refineries are exempt from the requirement to monitor air pollution around their property lines. Here's Wayne Nastri with the district.
We're focusing on the large facilities because those are the ones that everyone sees, that everyone is concerned about, and they require the most attention.
And that's just one problem. There are also harmful chemicals that air quality regulators aren't even monitoring. The public doesn't get consistent access to data about the air they're breathing. And even when regulators do find a problem, they're not required to find its root cause. But there's a bill working its way through the legislature right now that's trying to fill those holes.
It creates an even bar for all districts to require the same type of monitoring, the same type of reporting, and to have the same type of facilities subject to reporting.
State Senator Lena Gonzalez says her bill, called SB 674, gets rid of those exemptions for smaller refineries. It also expands the number of chemicals refineries have to monitor, ensures all this air pollution data is publicly available, and it requires the air districts to find the root cause of any problematic chemical spikes so they can be prevented in the future. Gonzalez says the goal here is consistency.
Air quality management districts are applying the law very inconsistently. Some of them are notifying the public, some of them are not. Some of them haven't defined what the threshold is in terms of what the exceedances are. Some of them are only reporting out five chemicals when there's 18 chemicals that should be reported out.
Six of the largest local refineries declined to comment on the bill for KCRW or never responded. Two of them deferred to a trade group called the Western States Petroleum Association, which said in a statement that they opposed the bill. They called it prescriptive, saying it doesn't ensure that monitoring systems are best suited for a particular community or facility. Gonzalez says it's supposed to be prescriptive. The point of the bill is to guarantee the same protection for everyone, including the very people who have suffered under the patchwork of inconsistent regulation.
Many of these low-income people of color, I feel, have been left behind. Many of them are in my district in Southeast Los Angeles and in Long Beach and in Wilmington. They don't feel like, you know, the air quality is great. They go outside, they get the nosebleeds, their kids have asthma. It's awful. On top of the diesel particulate matter from the ports, on top of the metal recycling plants scattered all over Los Angeles.
Locals like lifelong West Long Beach resident Whitney Amaya say their community is worth fighting for.
This is where I grew up. It's my home. And I think outside of that piece of like, this is my community and it's a place that I love, it's also like financially, I mean, everything right now is super expensive anywhere, no matter where you go. But I think it's also, the reality is, like, this is also what we can afford.
Amaya is sitting at a park bench. To her left is the football field of her old high school. To her right, a stone's throw away, is the Marathon Refinery, the biggest in the state. The haze is thick near their property, the same way the air looks thick above a recently driven dirt road.
Whenever it rains, it helps to clear up a lot of the pollution. So it's a reminder for me. I'm like, oh, the sky's not always supposed to be like murky or like cloudy or fuzzy or yeah, even though we're supposed to live in a very environmentally conscious place, there's definitely still a lot of work that needs to be done to like address all of the inequities that we see.
Senator Lena Gonzalez hopes SB 674 will do just that. It's working its way through state committees now, and she says if the governor signs it, the new requirements could go into effect on January 1st. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Coming up on Greater LA, how LA garment workers organize to affect the zoning regulations that will shape the future of downtown. That's just ahead.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back now with more of Greater LA. I'm Janaea Williams. Look at the tag on the shirt you're wearing. Does it say Made in the USA? If it does, there's a pretty decent chance it was sewn right here in downtown LA in the garment district where most of the garment manufacturing in the US happens. But in recent years, more clothing production has moved overseas. That's why some garment workers have been pushing to have a say in an overhaul of downtown's community plan. That's the new set of zoning rules that will shape development in downtown LA for decades to come. Jessica Coutts has been reporting on the plan for the 19th. That's an independent news organization based in Austin, Texas. And Daisy Gonzalez is campaign director for the Garment Worker Center, which has been at the forefront of the fight to keep garment manufacturing local. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jessica, I'll start with you. Can you give me a little background on what exactly this community plan is and what implications it could have for the future of the neighborhood?
Absolutely. So the Downtown Los Angeles Community Plan is essentially a land use plan that will rezone parts of LA in an effort to expand the amount of housing being built in the city, which is obviously greatly needed in Los Angeles, like it is in cities across the country. So this plan will open up, you know, new parts of the city to new housing construction. And in the case of the Fashion District, there were concerns over how this rezoning might impact garment manufacturing. As you know, a lot of those buildings, you know, could be redeveloped into apartment complexes. Some already have. in the past, and the Garment Worker Center was concerned that this would displace existing garment manufacturing and, you know, kind of compete with area garment manufacturers and also the places where garment workers live, which is in neighborhoods very close to the Fashion District.
Mm-hmm. So, Daisy, is that why the Garment Worker Center got involved? What's at stake for the folks who are working in the Fashion District?
Yeah, the Garment Worker Center got involved about 2 years ago because the garment workers that we represent throughout the state of California are really concerned about their jobs being displaced due to, you know, real estate pressures, real estate speculation, development. And in particular, the Fashion District holds, you know, the vast majority of garment manufacturing jobs for the entire state. You know, and workers are concerned about, you know, not being able to keep up with, you know, their own bills, their rents, right? And, you know, also being, you know, just at risk of not being able to, you know, to survive really in the city without the jobs that they rely on.
Mm-hmm. So what specific changes were you guys asking for in this plan?
So what garment workers recognize is that, yes, the city of Los Angeles does need more housing production, in particular, deeply affordable housing for the lowest income residents that are most at risk of homelessness. And, you know, they recognize that, you know, we all need to make compromises, right, and allow for more housing production. So nowhere in this plan are garment workers saying that housing should not be developed in the Fashion District. What we do want to see is, and what we were able to accomplish, because this plan was just approved by the full city council, was strong protections to prevent displacement of garment manufacturing from existing buildings, as well as in one small subsection of the Fashion District. You know, it's a 5-block area, essentially, mm-hmm. from west to east. In that area, we were able to gain a requirement for new construction to have between, you know, 1 or 2 stories of garment manufacturing required in new construction buildings. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, we were pushing for protections, pushing for preservation, and pushing for some incentives for new manufacturing space to be built.
Mm-hmm. And Jessica, if this industry and its workers aren't able to stay downtown, how would that impact the domestic fashion industry as a whole?
Los Angeles plays a huge role in domestic manufacturing in the United States. And so, you know, right now nationally, there is also a federal push to incentivize and to reshore domestic manufacturing. But if you lose a place like the Fashion District in Los Angeles, it's really hard to build back up that infrastructure. A lot of how that industry works in the city is it's comprised of a lot of small companies. So you have, you know, I talked to one owner, for example, who she works with a small like sewing company, and then she a few blocks away is where she takes her clothing to be cut. And then she has a pattern maker, and she has a dye house in a very close proximity to where she works as well. And so, you know, if you displace businesses from one of those buildings, which houses, you know, dozens of businesses, you're disrupting kind of this, it's like a ripple effect in the ecosystem.
And you talked to some business owners who said it would impact sustainable fashion specifically. So what did they tell you?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the owners that I talked to, Mary Price, you know, she used to work in kind of more of the global fashion industry before making the shift to owning her own company in Los Angeles. And, you know, she really said that one of the main benefits of being in LA and a way that also cuts down on the waste that I think consumers are becoming more aware of, you know, in the fast fashion industry, is the ability to produce small batches in Los Angeles because there mm-hmm. are so many of these smaller companies. There's a lot more flexibility in the number of garments that you have to commission. So when she was working abroad for these larger companies, you know, you had to meet these production minimums, which could be like, you know, you have to buy 1,000 of the shirt in 5 different colors, but you don't know if you have the consumer demand for that product yet. Whereas in LA, she can do really small batches and it's really cut down, you know, on production waste. And there's also just a simple fact of, The fashion industry is responsible for anywhere from 4 to 8% of global carbon emissions. And in a place like LA, someone like Price or these other small apparel companies are able to keep all their production in a really small part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then thirdly, there's other companies. There's another company in LA called Robro, and their whole business model is on upcycling textile waste that is produced in the fashion district and turning that into new garments.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really a lot going on in the city, and there's a lot of consumer demand for that as well.
So Daisy, you talked a little bit earlier about how garment workers have been pushing for more protections in recent years. Can you talk about how this plan plays into that struggle?
So garment workers, 2 years ago passed legislation statewide in order for the elimination of piece rate to exist in California. Garment workers are typically paid for every seam that they sew on a garment, and that can be paid at 2, 3, 5 cents. And so garment workers, are often not making the minimum wage. But because of this legislation, there's been more work around enforcement and, implementation of the Garment Worker Protection Act. It's just really unfortunate that soon after a victory like this and, garment workers really, organizing to improve their industry, now, they have this threat from this plan, Downtown LA 2040, that, would, without, these protections, without these incentives, just, dismantle this ecosystem that can, could continue to provide thousands of jobs for workers and, is really making a turn for the better.
Okay, so Daisy, you mentioned that you got a lot of the things you were advocating for worked into the plan. Do you consider this a victory? And are there any more changes you'd like to see happen?
Garment workers have been meeting with LA City Council members for the last year and a half and, really doing a lot of work to ensure that everyone understands, what's at risk, how many jobs and, how essential these jobs are for, immigrant workers throughout the city of Los Angeles, but also for, the local economy as well as the domestic economy. And we were able to win many protections. So, yes, we do consider this a victory and, really hope that the mayor approves this plan. I think she has a deadline of May 12th and that these protections, remain within this plan. And we look forward to also working with the city on implementation as well.
Daisy Gonzalez is campaign director for the Garment Worker Center here in LA. And Jessica Coots reports on gender, climate, and sustainability for the 19th. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Even more now with Greater LA, I'm Janaea Williams. Strikes are happening all over the country as unions have grown in size and strength in recent years. And while most of us in LA have the Writers Guild strike at top of mind right now, down in Orange County, there's a different kind of strike taking place. Drivers for Orange County's OC Access help people with disabilities get around the county. They've been without a union contract since the end of last year, and now those drivers have gone on strike, seeking higher wages and better terms. With us to talk about these happenings is our friend Gustavo Arellano. He's a columnist for the LA Times and a regular here on GLA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Janaea.
So I mentioned the drivers have been without a contract since the end of last year. So what are they asking for?
They're asking for what most people are asking for, just better wages, mm-hmm. more increase to the pension, better health benefits. But also specifically with these drivers, they're also asking that their bosses not impose mandatory overtime on them as what the last offer, according to them, was. And mm-hmm. also, according to the union that represents them, Teamsters Local 952, that the company also wants to institute mandatory 2.5-hour unpaid lunch breaks.
Oh,
and
goodness.
Also, they don't want to give them a raise. So a lot of issues happening here.
So what is the county saying about why they can't get past this impasse?
What's interesting about all of this is that Orange County Transportation Authority, which is in charge of all public transit in Orange County, they say they have nothing to do with this strike because the bosses, as it were, is another company that OCTA has contracted the services of, you know, for to drive around disabled and elderly folks in Orange County. So what the OCTA is saying is that we're just observers here. We can only urge both of the sides to get to a contract because it's affecting riders in Orange County. But for me, it's like, well, this is the perils of what happens when the government contracts out agencies and essential services to private contractors. Things like right. this do happen.
And there's no accountability. They're saying this is not us and they step back. But who is accountable?
Exactly.
So how many drivers does OC Access have? Is this a big union?
It's a relatively small union. We're talking about 250 drivers, about 100 mechanics. They're all on strike. The mechanics are not part of this contract, but they are in solidarity with them. But it doesn't matter how big or small the union is. The point is that they are in charge of a service that's really vital to a growing segment of the Orange County population, which is the elderly and also folks who cannot get around because of their disabilities. So this is why the OCTA, even though they're saying like, oh yeah, like we have nothing to do with this, they want this strike to end sooner rather than later because it's affecting a big, important part of what their services are to the county at large.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the mechanics are on strike in solidarity with the drivers. Is the union connected to any other Orange County employees who might support the strike and not cross any picket lines?
The OCTA, of course, is the drivers in the OCTA at large. They're represented by union as well. So far, they haven't gone on strike. But you have to remember, this strike only started on Wednesday. There was a picket last Friday at the Irvine headquarters of the company, that the private contractor that runs OC Access. And Orange County increasingly is becoming a union county. The chair of the Orange County Democratic Party, Ada Briseño, she is one of the secretaries to Unite Here Local 11, which is a very powerful union in Southern California that represents hotel workers, and in Orange County specifically in Disneyland. So if this strike continues, you can expect more and more visibility to these workers. Because again, right now it's just 250 people, but if the Democratic Party, Ada Briseño says, hey, let's start showing more solidarity, it'd be interesting to see what, if any, other unions join on the picket line or also just not working at all.
Interesting. So who uses this service? How many people are we talking about who will be affected by the strike?
The OCTA estimates that at its peak, there's 3,500 daily trips. So that a daily trip doesn't show how many people exactly do it, because sometimes it's going to be just one person getting picked up at their home. Other time, you're going to go to a senior facility. Like, I know a lot of elderly folks who do use that service, and it's a godsend to them. I mean, imagine an Uber, but an Uber that's run by the county and that's free of charge to these to the people who use it. Like, it is invaluable to a lot of these elderly folks.
Okay, so is service going to be gone completely?
The OCTA is saying to anyone who uses them, make alternative plans right now, because they're going to continue the service. It's going to be interesting to see how they continue the service, whether they're going to get replacement workers or maybe some OCTA drivers themselves to be able to use it. Because again, it's an invaluable, important part of county service. But I mean, you can imagine the regular drivers are on strike. They're not going to go back until there's a contract there. So if anyone does use the service, you're better off calling someone that you know to pick them up. And that's why the county needs to figure this out sooner rather than later, even if the OCTA says we have no fault in this at all.
So the county isn't offering any alternatives for people with disabilities to get around while the strike is happening?
Well, the OCTA buses are still around, so they're saying, well, we still have this bus fleet that you folks can use. It might not be the same as what you're used to, but at least it's something.
Goodness. Gustavo Arellano, always nice to speak with you.
Gracias.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, an Australian restaurant concept where the waiters insult and offend customers on purpose. So do you recruit jerks and meanies to staff the place, and will you go? That's coming up tomorrow on Greater LA. Tell us what's on your mind, share a story idea with us, and get the podcast. It's easy. Just go to kcrw.com/GLA or get the podcast wherever you get them by searching KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Sonia Geis, Nick Lamponi, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordal all helped put the show together this evening. I'm Janaea Williams. Thank you so much for your time. Have a great night.